Today on Follow Our Lead, I have the privilege of speaking with Dan Hirschberg, a true entrepreneur. Over the past 15 years, Dan has launched 4 successful companies, which include 2 sports apparel lines, Workhorse Brewing Company, and his latest venture, the Amateur Golf Society of America, AGS. From his initial risk of leaving his job at ESPN to starting a t-shirt company, Dan's journey teaches us the value of following your passions, the power in networking, believing in yourself, and putting your customers first. Dan, thank you so much for being on the Follow Our Lead podcast this afternoon. We are so excited to have you.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
We're going to dive right in. I've done some research about you, and it looks like you've always had an affinity for sports. And after you graduated from Cornell, you worked at ESPN for 2 years before starting your first business.
I did.
So I have to ask, what made you decide to leave what would appear to be a dream job?
It's a great question. And I think I asked myself the same thing as I was leaving. There were a variety of factors. You know, I think what I learned early on in the corporate environment was that I think I was always cut out for entrepreneurship. My father was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania for over 5 decades. And he ran a Center for Public Education Reform, where he was kind of autonomous and his own boss and made his own decisions. And even though that field wasn't particularly appealing to me, the opportunity to, kind of follow in my dad's footsteps from an autonomous standpoint was always in my ear. And he kind of planted that seed. So, you know, I loved my time at ESPN. I actually was recently out in California and had a little reunion with some friends there I hadn't seen for 15 years. But I just learned that, you know, listen, the flexibility that entrepreneurship afforded me, the kind of upside financial opportunity, and just the thought of being able to kind of craft my own path in life was something that really appealed to me. So ESPN was great, but definitely was not not long term in the cards.
Even from a young age, did you always want to be an entrepreneur, or is that something that just came over time?
Oh man, I don't think I ever had aspirations growing up, you know, when I was a teenager or going through high school or even into the beginning of college. I loved sports. So to your point, you know, ESPN really was a dream job for me. I think my high school yearbook, you know, and the I Want to Be When I Grow Up, I think it was an ESPN personality or a Flyers water boy. It's like one of the two. So it was really a good fit for me. And, you know, I think the more that I learned about just like the workforce in general, you know, I'd worked jobs. I worked for the Phillies when I was in college over the summer. My first internship was at Comcast Sportsnet. And prior to that, I worked at a sports radio in Chicago. So like, I loved sports. And if, you know, that led to an entrepreneurial opportunity within sports, great. If it kept me somewhere in the sports environment, that was also great. So hopefully that answers the question too.
It does. It absolutely does. So in terms of your entrepreneurial journey, so Let me know if I'm missing anything, but we've got Rivalryware, Workhorse Brewing Company, PhillyFaithful.com, and Amateur Golf Society of America.
What am I missing?
All right,
done.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So since we'll probably touch on some of these ventures, can you just give us a brief rundown of what each of these companies was or is so that
sure,
when we refer to them, our listeners know what we're talking about?
Yeah. So when I left ESPN, I left ostensibly to start Philly Faithful. So right around 2008, it was the fall of 2008, I was kind of approached by a cousin of mine who's a local guy as well, a few years older than me, at Cornell, and had said, hey, you know, I've seen some sports apparel companies in other major metropolises do really well in the e-commerce space. And at that time it was kind of, you know, social media was just on the cusp of kind of, you know, being used as a platform for advertising brands. And he was a very savvy, still is a very savvy, very smart guy, and kind of convinced me, hey, this is a great opportunity. And, you know, I left ESPN in part because the everything we just discussed, but I was also making, I think, $28,000 a year. So it wasn't like I was passing up a king's ransom to do something else. So I thought, you know, this is a great opportunity. I'm 24 years old. I have no real debts. I have no children. I have no responsibilities. I can just kind of see what happens. And basically put in my notice. And shortly after that happened, my cousin said, hey, I actually, I'm not going to leave my job. I like my job. He just got promoted. So I said, okay, great. Like, I'll just go do this myself. So ended up moving back into my childhood home in Northwest Philadelphia, and basically bootstrapped Philly Faithful, which was a Philadelphia sports apparel company. Timing was fortuitous because the Phillies won the World Series within weeks of me moving home. So I think people were slightly more receptive to buying Philadelphia sports apparel at that time, as I think everyone in the entire city became super nice for the first time ever, which is really kind of crazy. So I ran Philly Faithful. I've always joked that I think I'm probably the only Ivy League educated Jewish parking lot hustler in South Philadelphia sports history, because that's how it got started. I just, you know, went around. I had no advertising budget, no marketing budget, and really no idea what I was doing. So I just threw a bunch of shirts into my car and went down and sold them in the parking lot. So great sales experience, great kind of customer facing learnings. Learned a lot about myself. Work ethic and kind of what was required to tune out, you know, negativity. Most people aren't like actively looking to buy t-shirts from someone in the parking lot. So the fact that I was able to do it and grow it and then use it as kind of a stepping stone to actually establishing a real brand that had, you know, retail locations was a great lesson for me. So I ran Philly Faithful really full time until about 2016, 2017, when Workhorse Brewing Company kind of got put onto the radar. Rivalry Ware, it's just kind of a little tangent, was my first kind of foray into tech as far as like e-commerce was concerned. I launched a sports apparel company with a college friend of mine that kind of mimicked Philly Faithful in terms of the type of content, but had a whole different revenue model and had like different markets competing against each other, and price points would decrease as more people bought the shirt to support their fan bases. So it was a cool concept, but just couldn't really scale it, not being boots on the ground in different markets. So that was a very short-lived but kind of fun experience, good learnings. And then Workhorse really came about just kind of, again, on a whim. I was with that same cousin at his bachelor party in Austin, Texas. And I've told the story 100 times, but basically just day drinking Friday morning at the bachelor party. So get a couple 11 a.m. beers in you, and you know, good business ideas come. So I wonder if that's maybe a point to avoid for future entrepreneurs or something to lean into. But yeah, just ended up finding a friend of his had opened a brewery that became incredibly successful in Cincinnati. Spent the weekend chatting with him, and my uncle, who was also down there, really drove the ship on that and said, "Hey, I want to open a family brewery. Let's do it." And that's kind of what led to Workhorse. So that whole progression of, you know, getting an early stage startup, learning the ropes, kind of pivoting a little bit, but then coming back to my roots and then having an opportunity to do something at a much larger scale with Workhorse, which is, you know, obviously still very much open and doing well, even though I'm not involved. It's a pretty cool experience for sure.
Absolutely. And then now you're involved with this Amateur Golf Society of America, which is a really neat and interesting venture. So talk to us about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, with Workhorse, right around the time of the pandemic, you know, we were faced with the same challenge that I think the majority of on-premise businesses were faced with, which is how do you pivot from, you know, a world where your customers came to you to a world where we don't know if they'll ever come back or how long it will take for them to come back. And, you know, we were fortunate that we had built a pretty large scale production brewery, and we were able to kind of grow our distribution through canning products and sending them out. So that gave us, I think, a little bit more of a cushion to think about playing offense more. And I was essentially tasked by my board at that time to find ways to kind of creatively generate revenue opportunities for the business and meet our customers in a pandemic-proof manner. So golf, being that it was socially distant, outdoors, and experiencing a renaissance, it made a lot of sense. And golfers obviously enjoy drinking beer. So we thought, okay, I'm not obviously the first person to think about putting, you know, our beer at a golf course. How do you ensure that you add value to a course and their business operations beyond just selling them beer? Because they can buy beer from anywhere, but what can we do to become a better partner? And it was around that time that we said, let's investigate what type of golf, you know, ancillary golf opportunities exist to drive revenue to them. And I found out that our private equity backers, majority owner of the brewery, a company called MVP Capital, also had an ownership stake in Golf Genius, which is a tournament management software kind of industry leader in that regard, and had a chance to sit down with their C-suite and just kind of lamented, you know, my inability to play a lot of golf with 2 young kids and not belonging anywhere in this small business. And the very long story condensed is that we basically learned during that time that we could leverage their software to create this uniquely formatted model that is now the Amateur Golf Society. So we've launched it, allowed golfers to play essentially competitive tournament style golf on a flexible schedule. And after 2 years of growth at the brewery, we realized it was probably better served as a golf business, as a standalone golf business, than a kind of a beer brand. And we spun it out, did an asset purchase agreement, and then relaunched it as Amateur Golf Society at the beginning of 2023. And that's where we are today.
It's unbelievable. And you are very busy and in all these different ventures that are in all different industry areas. So I feel like I'm tired just thinking about the work that comes with all these things. These businesses all have synergy with each other. And you touched on that a little bit with the brewery and the golf society. Was it strategic to start these companies that touch similar markets? I mean, I recognize that with the pandemic, that added another sort of layer and probably had you questioning and looking into different areas that maybe you hadn't in the past because of what was going on. But I do think it's very strategic that these companies all align. So talk to us a little bit about that.
You know, I think at the end of the day, part of the reason I like being an entrepreneur is that you can pick kind of topics, focuses, businesses that you're passionate about. I find that, you know, in conversations with friends who are dissatisfied professionally, whether it's in a corporate environment, a small business environment, et cetera, it almost always stems around the lack of passion for the work that they do. So in my mind, it was, listen, if I, you know, I've only got one chance at this life, I'm going to associate myself with things that I enjoy. And, you know, maybe going from Philadelphia sports to beer and t-shirts and golf, like that's, people who know me will probably say like that's your tree right there. Like that's a pretty, pretty good representation of who you are and what you like. So, you know, they've kind of ended up spinning out off of each other in a weird way, just because of who I am and the network that, you know, I've built and the people that I'm close with. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, I do things that I enjoy doing because the work that is involved is not, it's not a small feat to your point, but it also doesn't feel tedious when it's something that you wake up feeling motivated to do on a daily basis.
And I think it's so nice because your customers at Workhorse and your customers at Philly Faithful and your golf people are all in the same circle and they all probably like the same things just like you do. Yeah. So it's very smart. So you're in all these different industry areas and it must be really hard to stay up to date on all of the education and the industry changes in these different areas.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of surrounding yourself with people who are smarter than you and really well networked and being willing to ask questions. One of the things that I love about broadly speaking entrepreneurship and small business is that, you know, most people in your realm of expertise are willing to offer advice and insight. So for example, the craft brewery, I kind of always felt like a fish out of water because I have no beer industry background. I never had a passion. I didn't homebrew. I really didn't know that much about beer coming into it outside of, you know, all the cheap domestic, you know, swill that I drank over my lifetime to that point, which my parents are listening. I'm sorry. But, you know, once we had an opportunity to meet people in the industry and just say, hey, I'm Dan. I'm really interested in what you're doing. If you could do it over again, what would you do differently? What's been your biggest success? People are generally willing to share insights and feedback if they believe that, you know, you're doing things for the right reason. So I think I've been fortunate to surround myself with a great group of people who are always willing to offer support. And it's part of the reason why whenever, you know, young entrepreneurs reach out to me or even veteran entrepreneurs or people who are interested in doing something they're passionate about, if they ask, hey, can I, you know, bend your ear? Pretty much always say yes, because that's how I got myself in the position I am today. And I think paying it forward is such an important part. So I would say a lot of it is just, you know, knowing who to ask to keep up on stuff. And then, you know, part of it too, let's be honest, is kind of faking it till you make it, right? So you know what you know, do what you do well. And then where you have gaps, you know, try to cover them to the best of your ability.
I love that because I think people are so afraid almost to get started in different spaces because they don't want to fail or they think they have to be perfect at it. I've used this example before, but I know nothing about podcasting. I am not a podcast expert. In fact, up until the last episode, I was using the microphone the wrong way. So that's for another day. But, you know, I almost didn't do it because I was so afraid that, you know, of the rejection and the failure of it that I was like, I don't know if I can do it. But then I figured, you know what, if I do it and it's awful, you know, nobody will listen to it. It'll be a learning experience and we'll see what happens. But I think the point is you're right. Like just to get started and do it and not be afraid of maybe the rejection that might come or getting in your own head.
Well, I think it's so cliche, you know, when people talk about, oh, you know, you learn so much from failures and, you know, that's how people grow. But I do think it is true. Like I've failed so many times in so many different ways. Thankfully, nothing significantly large to, you know, alter the course of my life, if you will. But, you know, if any of my businesses ceased to exist, like if Amateur Golf Society went out of business tomorrow, it wouldn't define who I am as a person. It wouldn't define my future moving forward. It wouldn't make me feel, obviously I'd feel sad and I'd be disappointed. And, you know, I'd have my investors I'd have to talk to. And there's a lot of complications on that side when things go wrong. But the reality is that, you know, in any of these businesses, it's just a stepping stone to the next thing. Realistically, like this business will not be, you know, my life until I'm 80 years old, right? Like it's just not, I'm realistic about that. So I think you take the lessons, you grow your network, and then you move on to whatever the next thing is and just try to stay positive and happy with wherever you are.
I love that. I have to ask, what was your motivation for continuing to start more and different businesses? You could have just stopped at, you know, the Philly Faithful and that would have been great and fine. Tell me why you kept going.
You know, I think some of this at the end of the day is really my own opinion of myself, where I hold myself to a very high standard and I feel like I've yet to really achieve the goals in life that I want to. Again, like I could retire, quote unquote, tomorrow. I certainly don't have the resources to do so, but like I could stop entrepreneurship and I could look back and say, okay, I learned this much. I did these many things and that's great. And I should be proud of myself. But you know, I feel like there's always more. And I think I want to prove to myself and the people that have backed me, you know, financially, emotionally, what have you, with a really big success. And so that's what drives me. And it's not all financial success, right? But it's creating a business that has a legacy or adds value to its users, members, community. At the end of the day, as I said, that's really my ultimate goal, is to kind of make a positive impact and ensure that my family is set up and the people that have supported me, you know, come away feeling similarly. So that's probably why I keep doing either that, or I'm just completely crazy or something.
Might be a little bit of both.
I think it probably is a little bit of both. My wife would probably say the same.
All right. So I want to talk about networking. We know that networking is just as important as education, maybe even if not more so. How were you able to grow your industry contacts in these different areas? In the accounting world, you know, we build our contacts within that area and then of course within our different sectors of business. But I can't imagine if I worked for another company or was involved with something else that was outside of accounting, how difficult that might be for me to build my network. Mm-hmm. So how were you able to do that?
Yeah, I think it starts with the people that are your actual friends. Right. It's not like someone who gets into business is just, you know, hitting every single social networking opportunity or dropping your business card in a thing going that way. It's you talk to the people who are close to you from a personal relationship, you know, in whatever walk of life that is, whether it's your school, your summer camp, your neighborhood, you develop relationships with people and you don't develop them ostensibly to get value out of it in the future. But when you treat people the right way and you care about them and you make a, you know, concerted effort to be supportive of their ventures personally or professionally, that stuff tends to pay itself forward and tends to kind of, you know, bear fruit, I guess, for lack of a better term. I think Philadelphia in particular is one of these crazy small circle cities where, you know, we have 1.5 million people in the greater metro area, but like everybody knows everybody. And I always chuckle with that because it's like what we were talking about before we got on the recorded portion of this call, is like connections that we had, we saw through LinkedIn, and that's really very much Philadelphia in a nutshell. So I think the majority, you know, the relationships I've been able to develop professionally have come out of, oh, my good friend knows this person, they're happy to make an introduction. And then you meet that person, then you go spend a day with them and their colleagues. And then you meet three of those colleagues who you realize you have a shared interest or you have a shared connection. And then that expands and that expands. At its core though, it's, you know, treating people with respect and making sure they understand that you're not in it to get something out of it. You're in it to listen and to support them and to hopefully provide them something of value. And then as long as you continue with that kind of, you know, general MO, good things will come from it.
So when you decide that you're going to take on another business opportunity, how do you ensure that these ventures are profitable and sustainable? At least if it was me, I would be terrified that if I started something in a new industry area that it would flop. Mm-hmm. So what is your method for taking on a new opportunity in that regard?
Well, I've learned so much. I mean, when I started Philly Faithful at 24, I didn't have a formal business plan. I had no revenue model. I had no idea of what I was doing. And I remember coming home, I think probably within the first couple of weeks of moving back into my childhood home, and my father saying like, well, where's your business plan? Like, how much revenue are you anticipating? I was like, I don't know. I'll figure it out. Like, I don't know. How am I supposed to know? And he was like, you're an idiot. you're never going to be successful. And I was like, I'll figure it out. And then I obviously learned very quickly that, you know, data and numbers and facts are a very important part of small business, right? So I think every venture that I've started, I've learned a lot more about how much time and effort needs to be put into the business model of the business. And it's like a great thing to have an idea and be creative and be well-networked and be passionate. But if the dollars and cents don't match up to, you know, where you need it to be, then the business doesn't stand a chance. So I think specifically with this most recent venture, trying to create a business model that is hyper capital efficient, that's super lean from a human resources standpoint, that's scalable without kind of commensurate human resources scale. Like, those are all the decisions now that I've learned over time to help grow a business. And this business is so new that, you know, while I am incredibly optimistic on the future and we've seen some really good initial data, I have no idea if it's going to be successful. I'm confident and I believe it will, but you know, you have to look at, you have to look at your model and make sure that the numbers you put on paper are realistic and they're not aspirational. And if that checks out and it feels like even with a kind of conservative lean or some, you know, worst case scenario or contingencies, it still has an opportunity to be successful, then go for it. But if you model it and it doesn't look good under any circumstance, then, you know, throw that out and don't even consider it, no matter how exciting it might seem.
You've had plenty of businesses, and I'm sure in more particular with Workhorse, you have quite a few staff. So what would you say is your leadership style and how do you kind of cultivate a good company culture there?
Yeah, Lena, I mean, to be honest with you, I kind of ask that same question to people around me, because I think if I could evaluate myself as an entrepreneur, as a founder, as a leader, one of my kind of Achilles heels has been, I've always been more autonomous. You know, Philly Faithful, I was a sole proprietor, right? So I didn't have to answer to anybody outside of my partners. I didn't have investors. I didn't have sponsors. I just had myself and my customers. So I learned how to, you know, kind of develop those relationships. And then when we went to Workhorse, it was definitely a shock. I'd never been in a position of hiring and growing a team. And I kind of just defaulted to like, all right, well, I work really hard. I'll set the tone by getting out there and putting my boots to the ground and kind of like leading by doing. And I think to a degree that is helpful, right? Like, people in your organization need to see that you're not afraid to take on any task and you're not above any work. But you know, part of it is still where I'm learning. Like, I have not had enough of a track record, right, of building super large teams. And even my role at Workhorse, I only ran a handful of employees under my purview. So I think for me, it's always been lead by doing, you know, be honest, be transparent, be accountable, and then be available to people and let them know that you're, you know, you're the same person they are, right? You have the same anxieties and same trepidations and same, you know, fears that they do. But this is how you tackle and approach them. So I think as I grow Amateur Golf Society, I hope to be able to, you know, lean into people in my network to help me grow that culture and do a better job. Because at the end of the day, you know, I like doing the work that I do, but I also don't feel like my ultimate role is to be a CEO in the company. That's not what I want to do in my professional career. I've kind of had to by default. But yeah, I think it's a great question. If you figure out how to do it, let me know, because I would love to learn more.
Listen, we're always working on it too.
One thing that's been super helpful for me is essentially having like an advisory board of people close to you who aren't your board of directors, who aren't, you know, paid or involved in the business on a day-to-day, but people from different backgrounds, different industries who can offer their input. And I'd had opportunities to be part of more formal organizations that did that. And I don't know, personally, I never really enjoyed it. It always felt more forced. So I just kind of went to a group of about a half a dozen people that, again, had been part of my network in various ways, whether it was personally or professionally, and just said, hey, would you like to serve kind of as an advisor to me, where then I can bring you together with another five people and we can kind of all support each other through this process. It's not just me coming to them saying, hey guys, I'm struggling with sales, you know, figures, or I'm struggling to build culture. But you have those conversations about everyone's individual challenges. And it's amazing how much overlap there is, regardless of company size and industry and background. So
it's so true too. I think in a lot of the networking groups I'm in, we have, it's the same conversations and the same issues that come up over and over again, culture being one of them. You know, how do we keep employees? How do we retain such great employees, keep them happy and satisfied and working as hard as they can without burnout, and you know, all of those big questions everyone wants the answer to in the business community. So all of your ventures have been very successful. What do you think is the secret sauce? Is there a common denominator? Was it, you know, strong strategy or really keen strategic partnerships? What do you think you might be able to attest that to?
Yeah, you know, and appreciate the kind words, and I hope that people attached to these projects and the folks who have, you know, supported the businesses feel the same way about the value that it brings. I think really where everything starts is like, are you providing a good experience to your users, your customers, the people who are engaging with your business? Do you care about them legitimately? Are you communicative? Are you available? Are you a problem solver? Are you accountable if things go wrong? And I remember telling the anecdote I learned very early at Philly Faithful that I felt like it was almost better for me to like ship the wrong shirt intentionally, which I obviously never did. But if I did that and then very quickly fixed it by saying, hey, keep that one, I'll send you a new one free of charge, and get back to that person within, you know, 5 minutes of them emailing. And that customer, even though I made a mistake, ended up being my most valuable customer, you know, over the lifetime of the business. And that happened a bunch of times, right? So I think the learning from that is, you know, people, especially in this region, really all they care about is authenticity and accountability. You know, your product has to be good or your service has to be of value. But if you take care of folks and you make a commitment to giving them a positive experience, we all have touch points personally and professionally that are less than ideal on a day-to-day basis. And if you can count on that one business partner, you know, doing what they tell you to do at a bare minimum or what they say they were going to do, that makes a huge difference. So I think any success that I've had has been predicated upon, you know, our ability to take care of people and show them that we legitimately value their business. And it's not dollars and cents. It's making sure that they're satisfied with the whole experience from top to bottom.
Being able to do that, you have to have a lot of self-awareness to recognize what you need to work on as a leader and also as a company.
I think so much of it is just listening to what people tell you, right? There's no secret sauce to calling somebody and saying, hey, you know, thank you for supporting my business. What am I doing well? What am I not doing well? And obviously not everyone's going to pick up the phone and give you candid answers. And that's one of the struggles of entrepreneurship is the people close to you who care so deeply about your success are often hesitant to give you honest feedback because they don't want it to hurt you. And I've always told my friends the exact opposite. It's like, be really critical. Like, tell me everything I'm doing wrong. I'll hear the good stuff from other people, but like, tell me what I'm doing wrong and how I can get better. And I think people who take that to heart and listen to the folks who are literally spending their hard-earned money supporting your business, if those people are willing to open up their wallets to support you, they are most likely also going to tell you what's good and what's not good. So just pay attention, listen, get that feedback, and then apply it and actually pay attention.
Really being able to give people a voice and then do something with it is very empowering for the people around you, whether it be your employees or just somebody in your circle.
No, it's so true.
I want to talk about Amateur Golf Society of America because I really do think that you're revolutionizing the golf industry. I don't golf, but I can tell you right now, my husband thinks you're revolutionizing the golf industry. So I'll give you that. This is a new technology, a new idea. What's your plan for educating the public on what you do and what the purpose of Amateur Golf Society of America is?
Yeah. So this is really interesting. And it's one of our challenges that, you know, when we took this out of the brewery, you know, we had done some surveys and kind of tried to get a better understanding of like, hey, how did we grow so much year one to year two? What do our members like? And what was really interesting is that the feedback was split almost evenly amongst 3 to 4 different answers of, well, we love your flexible scheduling, or we love being able to compete regardless of skill level, or we love all the courses that you host events at, or we love the advanced access to tee times. And in one way, that's great, right? We offer a whole slew of value props that make our you know, essentially our project appealing to golfers everywhere. But what makes it difficult is from a marketing standpoint and from a kind of concisiveness of messaging, you can't identify one and pull that out because that might not be the one that stands out to the majority of your golfers. So, you know, when we think about what AGS is moving forward, it is many things to many people. It offers a whole different variety of perks. But the challenge for us is making sure that we communicate that to people in a clear and concise manner and that they see that value. And that doesn't matter if they can use our membership to play 30 different public courses or they just want to play 2 private courses they couldn't get access to. They're still the same value to us, and we want them to be active and part of our community. In terms of kind of like revolutionizing, I'm flattered to hear that. And I'm thrilled that, you know, your husband feels that way. And hopefully we can get you into our women's division for some point this year, because we got plenty of stories of people who had never picked up a golf club before and they've done this. And it's been an addictive experience. You know, we just want to give people opportunity to get involved with the game of golf. I'm in love with the game. I think it's a fantastic experience. I've loved the people I've met on the golf course, the, you know, challenge to your own kind of personal ego. It's a very humbling game, but it does have a lot of lessons that are applicable, you know, outside of the golf course, from patience and perseverance and, you know, practice makes perfect type of stuff. So we're just excited to hopefully grow playing opportunities and access to people who have traditionally struggled to find both of those, and doing it in a way that's both affordable and exciting and fun.
We've talked a little bit about your network and how you've been able to expand that and grow it. But you've partnered with the Golf Association of Pennsylvania in this venture, and I think it's a really smart partnership. So talk to us about how you were able to build that relationship.
Just one correction, Golf Association of Philadelphia.
Oh, good. Okay, Philadelphia.
Yeah, so they're, but I say that in part because they're an amazingly prestigious, venerable, but also progressive and exciting and fun to work with partner. They've been around forever, and I think part of the reason that it's been a good fit for both parties is that, you know, we help solve some problems that they've had in terms of growing the public side of golf on the amateur, you know, league component in particular. But the equity that they provide to us, you know, brand equity, legitimacy is huge. You know, they believe in the vision. They see opportunities to help grow the game through our platform. And really where I see them playing a huge role for us is helping us scale this project in terms of sharing the value with partner associations as we move into new markets. And that's actively what we're looking to do for 2024 and beyond is take this concept and this project and bring it into other areas where we don't currently have a presence. But Gap has done so much to grow the game of golf, both locally and in this region. They're just a terrific partner. Love working with them. Can't say enough nice things. And it's also cool for our members too, because when they join AGS, they become a member of Gap as well. So they get access to all of the Gap perks, from member play days to, you know, magazine access to handicap management tools, and really just opportunities to chat with people who know and love the game of golf.
And I think being able to build the community of belonging is really special, especially with this partnership, even within just your Golf Society of America is its own community. But to have that added value, I think is really special.
Yeah, the networking on golf is arguably one of the best things for it. It's, you know, certainly you can be paired with a random person every once in a while who you don't like, but I can count, you know, the number of people I've met through the game of golf just by getting paired up with them in a foursome and driving some sort of connection with that person. You know, maybe it's a professional connection, maybe it's a personal connection. Maybe they know somebody who knows somebody that leads to a business deal for those folks. I mean, it's just a great way to meet people and kind of be part of something for sure.
I love that you mentioned your women's division, because like I said, I trip over my own 2 feet. I'm horrible at anything athletic. There are so many people in our office, we've had this conversation, the women, we're like, we really want to get into it because we feel like we're missing opportunities because we don't know how, or we just don't know where to get started. We're embarrassed, whatever. So this is really good to know. We have one very good golfer in our chat support office. So, her concern was, is that she never has anybody to play with because all the rest of us don't know how. So well, you're solving two problems there.
That's the hope. And I think something that we can do better, and we'll probably roll more up into this in future years. So we have a partnership with the Philadelphia section of the PGA, and the teaching professionals locally here are some of the best in the country, right? And they give access to lessons and clinics and ways to get excited, because our expectation is not that you pick up a club for the first time and you play 30 tour events, right? It's just not feasible. But I think the baseline, and every golfer will kind of attest to this, doesn't matter how many times you play, you're going to embarrass yourself, even if you're a veteran golfer. It's just a very hard game. So I think getting people in and letting them understand that it's pretty much impossible to pick up the game and be exceptional right away, that there is a learning curve. And even when you're good, there's continual challenges. And I know that might not sell it as much, might sound masochistic in a way. But the reality is that, you know, you're like everybody else. It's a challenging game. It's a lot of fun. And we want to provide opportunities for folks to get better, be part of a community, use our pairings program to meet new golfers that share similar schedules. So there's a lot of really cool things I think we can do to support those, you know, those needs.
I think so too. Amateur Golf Society of America, it uses an application. Is that right?
Yeah. So we have what's called a progressive web app. So in lieu of, you know, downloading an app from the app store, what you do is you register on our website at amateurgolfsociety.com. That will take you to app.amateurgolfsociety.com. And once you've registered, you can basically just add the app to your home screen. We have some like PDFs that we share in an email upon registration that show you how to do that. It's literally you click two buttons and then it functions exactly like a mobile app. And the reason that that's beneficial for us is because we make so many updates to our tournament schedule, to new sponsors, to member perks. So not having to go through the app store and wait for that process in real time is pretty cool. But it's a cool application. We do a lot of unique things in there, from the exclusive advanced access to tee times for our members, so they're not competing with the general public to find spots to play. They get exclusive member perks that, you know, you can't find on our website. They're only available in our app from partners like Golf Galaxy and True Linksware. So there's a lot of really cool stuff in there, as well as the leaderboard, so you can kind of scratch that competitive itch.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there's going to be people in our office listening to this that will be signing up as we speak. They're very competitive in the accounting world. Again, with this app though, we're diving into the tech space, and you talked about this a little bit in the beginning. Was it really difficult to get into that space? I would think getting your foot in the door had to have been challenging.
Same thing, I think, with just small business life in general. It's just asking questions and learning. So yeah, I've never built an app. And you know, we're only what, a couple months into the season, and we started the app build really in August of last year, September. So we're not even a year into the process, and I've learned so much in that time. So if like I started this app from scratch, tomorrow, I would make a ton of different decisions. And that's part of learning, right? You kind of optimize and streamline. And it's been really cool because the company Golf Genius that I mentioned previously, you know, they have a wealth of knowledge and experience in the space and help facilitate the introduction to the development firm that we're using that has a ton of experience in the golf space. They've built Jin's app, they work with Golf Genius. So they're a great partner, and they've been super patient and flexible and understanding and supportive, and just really have been a great partner. So that makes things, regardless of what part of the industry you're involved with, makes it great. But yeah, from a tech standpoint, everything we are doing is designed to kind of automate and streamline our operations and make sure that we're, you know, driving value to our members and giving them a product that they can be excited about.
When you thought of the idea of Amateur Golf Society, did you always envision the app as being part of it, or did that come along the way?
Yeah, you know, we didn't have an app when this was the workhorse tour at the brewery. And some of that was due to just the resources required to do it. And this kind of, you know, blew up. It was never something that we had budgeted for in the brewery itself. So when we knew we were going to take it out of the brewery, an app became a huge component. We wanted to, you know, give people an opportunity to, you know, essentially collect in one space. We wanted them to have access to everything in one spot and be able to connect with the community. So knew it was going to be part of it. And I think just the reality of the business world we're in the summer of 23 is that you have to have a good tech component to be relevant.
Absolutely. Do you think the app will make it possible for more amateurs to become maybe rising stars in golf by winning tournaments or getting noticed or picking up sponsorships? I think that may very well happen.
I mean, it would be a very exciting day for us if someone who started their career on the Amateur Golf Society eventually made their way up to lower levels of golf. I mean, there are some golfers that we have that, you know, what we consider a scratch golfer. So basically, you know, a zero handicap or a plus handicap. Golf is such an incredibly competitive space in terms of the number of great golfers there are. And it's one thing to be competitive and be skilled in a competition like ours where there's not, you know, fans alongside or there's not, you know, scoring officials on site. But hopefully this gets people, you know, back to a high level of play, and then they can qualify and enter into, you know, local and regional competitions. But yeah, I would love to see that happen. And certainly, if nothing else, it'll give people more opportunities to refine their game and enjoy playing more golf.
So what advice do you have for aspiring entrepreneurs who maybe aren't sure where or how to get started? What do you think is the best piece of advice you can throw our way?
So it's a really great way to tie up, I think, some of what I've said earlier, where I think you start with finding something you're passionate about and, you know, making that your kind of business decision, right? If you love accounting, you know, find a business that has a heavy accounting component. If you love golf, find a business that has a heavy golf component. But like, I wouldn't start an accounting startup, right? I'm not passionate about accounting. And I imagine, you know, you seem like you're interested in golf, but I would not recommend that you start a golf business. So, you know, you pick something that you care about and that you love and start there, come up with an idea, and then stress test it from a financial standpoint. You know, if this is going to be your decision in terms of where you want to take your career, is there a financial outcome that is going to make you happy? Because there are some businesses that might be profitable or they might be break even, and you can pay yourself the salary you want and maybe save a little bit of money. And that's enough. Like a business that makes $100,000 a year can be very successful if the person running it is a sole proprietor and that's the check that they want to bring home. So like there's no, it's not what the raw number is, it's just what you're satisfied with. So I would recommend to people, you know, really take the time to get a good model in place and see the whole array of outcomes. And if the ultimate upside is worth it or the ultimate downside is not worth it, then, you know, take emotion out of it and base your decisions on facts and data and logic. That makes it a little less kind of sexy, if you will, but I think it's going to save you a lot of trouble in the future. And then I think the last thing, again, just kind of reiterating some of the stuff I've said earlier, is just ask questions. Just, you know, find people who are in that industry or are tangentially related to that industry or have, you know, kind of skill sets that would be applicable in that industry, and just ask them their questions and insight and advice. And I'm sure you will find the same things that I found, where you learn a lot in those conversations and it helps inform decisions to, you know, help you grow your company or decide maybe it's not worth doing at all.
You've taken some major risks, especially going into markets that are new. Talk to us a little bit about ways in which you were able to make that those leaps.
I think some of it too, again, is just like, you're going to take, if you want anything to be really successful, there is some degree of risk involved. You know, there's doing something conservatively and kind of staying home and not worrying about it. Like that's never really going to pay off the way I think that most people want it to. You know, I'm still learning with these new markets. We've had a really good experience kind of getting up and off the ground, but, you know, at least this year in AGS, you know, most of our growth has been in our home market, and, you know, expanding in those new territories has been more challenging. I mean, there's definitely some traction and we've gotten some great course partners, but we want more play in those regions. We want more people signing up. So that's my biggest challenge, is trying to make sure that, you know, I dedicate the resources and think strategically about, you know, how to grow those markets. I would say that the risk is, you know, in my business, the way that we built our model is that the amount of members that we need in each given market is not substantial for the business to be cash flow positive. So, you know, for me, it is a risk from a time standpoint, but in terms of a member acquisition standpoint, it doesn't feel, you know, insurmountable at any level. So that's why I can kind of operate comfortably knowing that I don't need to shoot the moon, you know, to kind of be successful. So that's how I built this particular model, if you will.
And I think that's great advice for people listening as well. Can you share with us a favorite leadership book or podcast? We are starting a little library in our office. Ooh. That has been growing. So yeah. Is there anything you can recommend for us?
Well, so a podcast that I've really enjoyed listening to, and I actually had the opportunity to go on personally, is called The Pitch. So I originally listened to a show. I mean, I think most people are familiar with NPR. And then there was a producer, Alex Bloomberg, who did the Startup podcast years ago. Which is basically this whole like meta thing about, I'm going to tell a podcast about starting a podcast company. So he did that. I listened to that. That turned into Gimlet, which produced a show called The Pitch, which was then bought by Spotify and then subsequently bought back by the original owners. And their whole concept is they bring on founders and entrepreneurs to essentially pitch their business to a panel of venture capitalists. And you basically go on the show and you talk about your business and your value prop. And then they decide by the end of the show if verbally they're going to make an investment at the valuation and kind of investment terms you've put out. So as an entrepreneur, I've been incredibly fascinated by that, because from a leadership standpoint, you hear tales from VCs who've been through it all, right? They've had successes and failures of, you know, massive levels on both ends of that. They've interfaced with business leaders in all different industries. And then you hear from other founders who can offer, you know, their experience and their, whether it's related to your industry or not, there's some kind of applicable learnings from every show. So I've just been a huge fan of that show. I think it's a really great tool to learn, and it's just also really entertaining, which is nice when you're in the car a lot.
Oh yeah. I think that's going to be on my list, because I've never heard of that.
So. Oh, it's terrific. Can't recommend it enough.
Before we totally close out, is there anything else you want to share or add before we wrap up?
Come play golf with us. So sign up for the Amateur Golf Society at app.amateurgolfsociety.com. We want new golfers. We want old golfers. We want people who haven't played golf for a while because of family or work or, you know, whatever the reason is. So yeah, if you like golf and you're listening to the show and you want to play, please reach out to us with any questions. We'd love to get you on tour and have you come and join our community.
And what a great way to build company culture.
Huge way. We've talked a lot. This is probably more of a longer podcast conversation, but, you know, we think that there's a lot of value in terms of business partnerships, right? It's not just like a sponsorship and a brand exposure where you pay some money and you get your name in an app. It's, you know, how do you acquire new customers? How do you facilitate, you know, business networking? It's not like, hey, Jim snuck out at 1 o'clock because the boss wasn't there to go play golf. It's no, we use golf as a work life, you know, mental health benefit, but also help formalize, you know, Jim's looking for new leads in this industry. Come join the tour. And we have, you know, player cards that show industries people are in and what they want to do. So I think there's a lot of really interesting applications to make it successful for businesses of all sizes.
Dan, thank you so much for being here. This was awesome. I really appreciate your time. And I think our listeners are going to love everything that you said.
Well, yeah, thank you again so much. And just for your own edification, I think you're crushing it on the podcast side. So you have nothing to be worried about. The cadence is on point. The articulation's good. The questions are good. You're nailing it. So good job doing it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We will talk to you soon and we'll be golfing with you soon.
I look forward to it.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye. From Dan's humble beginnings selling t-shirts in parking lots, he acquired valuable sales experience, developed a strong work ethic, and cultivated face-to-face customer interactions. These experiences laid the foundation for his subsequent successes with Workhorse Brewing Company and the Amateur Golf Society of America. Dan recognizes that every endeavor, regardless of the outcome, is a stepping stone to the next opportunity. By maintaining this forward-thinking mindset, he continues to chart new paths and expand his entrepreneurial horizons. Until next season,